And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's December 15th. Currently 32 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 28 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. We're looking at your forecast for your Monday. It features lots of sunshine, a couple of high clouds out there for you throughout the day, but not a bad day. Well above average. Once again, with these temperatures, highs will likely climb to around the 50-degree mark in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low to mid-50s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Tuesday, look for partly sunny skies out there. We'll see a few more clouds moving into the area. There's a very slim chance of an isolated sprinkle developing, but mainly should be dry during the day. High temperatures will climb to about 50 degrees again in Park City. We'll see those highs into the low to mid-50s for us in the Heber Valley. Changes arrive Tuesday night into Wednesday, though, as we start to see at least a grazing pass by an atmospheric river to our north, and that should be enough to bring in some moisture here across the northern mountains and the northern areas, including the Wasatch Back, as we go throughout your Tuesday night into Wednesday. That means the potential of some valley rain showers showing up there for us Tuesday night into Wednesday, and the mountains, especially once you get above about 7,500 feet, a good chance of at least a rain-snow mix coming in. Now, temperatures overall are not going to be too cold, so overall this is not going to be a significant event for areas below 7,000 feet, but you could have a couple of snowflakes mixing in with the rain for us around Park City with highs in the mid-40s. But your morning low temperatures will be in the mid-30s. So again, mainly staying above freezing during this event. The Heber Valley, you're looking at temperatures around the freezing mark to start, but temperatures quickly climbing to near 50 in the afternoon. So any snow accumulation looks to primarily be well above about 7,500 feet to 8,000 feet or so. And even there, the amounts will remain fairly light out there with this type of snow. Now, as we go into your Thursday, we'll have isolated showers possible across the area with temperatures in the 40s for highs for the Wasatch Back. And maybe a stronger storm system arriving as we get towards your Friday night into Saturday. And that could have a better chance of bringing at least a rain-snow mix to the Heber Valley and a better chance of maybe rain changing to snow for areas like Park City with some accumulations. We'll keep an eye on it for you. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Kane.
And on the phone with us, with a look in the backcountry, we have Greg from Utah Avalanche Center on the phone with us. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Leslie. Good to talk with you for the first time this season.
Yeah.
And it was certainly good to hear about some upcoming weather in our weather forecast. We've been stuck in this persistent ridge of high pressure for the last, well, for most of this fall, really. And certainly over the last week, we've just had sunshine and warm temperatures. The good news is that the snow, we have the lowest sun angle of the year, of course. The solstice is just about a week away. So we haven't lost a whole lot of snow. Certainly on the northerly slopes, we're holding up. And the snow is still supportable, even though we have a really thin snowpack, 1 to 2 feet at most. I'm saying the danger is in the Salt Lake and Park City Mountains, mostly low, but we do have some isolated slopes, northerly facing slopes above about 9,000 feet, where it remains possible to trigger a slab avalanche 1 to 2 feet deep. And it's going to fail in some of that weak, sugary snow that's found down near the ground. I was along the Park City Ridgeline yesterday and looking at the snowpack there, and I was still getting some loud collapses and cracking, and other stability tests were showing that there remains a possibility, even though it's isolated, there remains a possibility of triggering an avalanche. And yeah, let's hope we get some more precipitation coming up this week. Wednesday, Thursday, maybe. And you just heard the forecast. It doesn't look like a whole lot of accumulations, but we could see some decent water amounts out of this. So it's possible by the weekend we'll have an increased avalanche danger. But for now, yeah, another sunny day for today and tomorrow.
Okay, Greg, thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye bye.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Fire District Marshal Mike Owens. Later on, Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher with an update on the youth sport programs, as well as a representative from Kodiak with details on the ongoing and continuing partnership with YSA. And finally, Park City Recreation Director Ken Fisher in with details on some of the construction projects they've got going on, as well as their winter programming. Well, the Summit Land Conservancy says another 2.5 miles of trails leading to the Uinta Mountains are now preserved as open space. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that Oakley City Council closed the deal last week.
The Oakley City Council approved a conservation easement on city-owned trails east of Pinyon Lane Wednesday. The agreement covers 81 acres in all. Mayor Zane Wolstenhume, who signed the agreement, says the terms are probably tighter than any other conservation easement Oakley has worked on with the Summit Land Conservancy.
It is going to protect in perpetuity those assets that the city has, and yet it will give us the flexibility if we want to do trail improvements, if we need to make more infrastructure improvements for our water system.
The Summit Land Conservancy will hold and enforce the easement, which bans future development but upholds trail use. According to Oakley Recorder Amy Rydalch, the easement covers land that's home to important city wells.
All of this area in some fashion is geographically the area where we have our highest value water assets. It's also in an area that is considered sensitive lands from our official city maps. This is an area where most of the area is in excess of 30% slope. And so this is not an area that we would want to particularly see developed for that reason as well.
Summit Land Conservancy CEO Cheryl Fox calls the conservation easement a testament to city land trust collaboration. She says it's the third project Summit Lands and Oakley have done together, and part of the wider Weber River Pathway Initiative.
About 10 years ago, a group of citizens from Oakley came to the Summit Land Conservancy, and they had a vision of a path, a trail, all along the Weber River as it runs through Oakley. And it was really inspiring.
The property covered by the latest easement is across Pinyon Lane from the newly expanded Oakley Bike Park, as well as another potential land trust project, a green cemetery. The east and west sides of the road are all one property, but the city council has not decided on what the terms of a cemetery conservation easement should be.
It's always good that the city takes time to really analyze the uses of these properties, because these conservation easements are forever.
Adding an easement on the other side of Pinyon would mean preserving another 63 acres at the foot of the Uinta Mountains. Summit Land Conservancy is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The holidays are here. Lots of cooking and baking happening in the kitchen. And once the temperatures start to cool off, maybe we'll see some more fireplaces in use. In the studio now with some fire safety suggestions is Park City Fire District spokesman Mike Owens. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why do the holidays tend to be the a higher risk time for residential fires and emergencies?
You know, there's a few things that we do extra right around the holidays. Decorations are a big one, so we increase the fire loading in our home. But two of the biggest things that we see, extension cords, you know, you got to run extension cords to get those lights going, and candles, both of which they're perfectly safe to use as long as you use them right.
Yeah. I guess, what is it that kind of calls that the fire district sees, I mean, increase during the winter months?
Well, so of course we have our ski season, so our medical calls go up a tremendous amount. A lot of ski transports from the resorts. And then we just have more people in town, so more slips and falls, more people out having a good time and making decisions that lead to a less good time a little bit later in the evening. So we see a lot of increase in those. And then we see just use increases. So as people use, you mentioned fireplaces, it's colder. People like to use their fireplaces, and the vast majority of fireplaces are well-maintained. People take care of them. They get their chimneys cleaned every year like they should. But sometimes the fireplaces have problems in them. In fact, we had a fire just a couple of weeks ago where it was no fault of the family that was using it. The chimney had just failed to work the way it was supposed to and had allowed heat into the chimney chase and lit the chimney chase on fire.
And what happened?
Luckily, the family found it. The smoke detectors had gone off, and that alerted the family. They started looking around. They saw what was going on. They called us, and we were able to put the fire out. It was limited to just the chimney chase. It did some damage around that area, but the chimney chase is what took the brunt of it. And luckily the house was saved.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, I mean, everyone should have smoke alarms in their living spaces. How many working smoke alarms should a home have, and where should they be installed?
The biggest thing is how many bedrooms you have. So, of course, smoke alarms are a life safety device, and they're there to wake you up or to let you know if there's smoke in the house. So you should have at least one in every bedroom. plus one outside of every sleeping area. That doesn't mean you need to have one outside of every bedroom. If you, say, have a hallway and you have three or four bedrooms off that hallway, you would want one in the hallway and then one in each one of those bedrooms.
Okay. And, I mean, will they still work? I mean, in the bedroom if the doors are closed?
One of the best things that have happened to smoke alarms in the last, about 30 years ago, they started interconnecting the smoke alarms. So when one goes off, then they all go off. So if you notice in any of the newer homes, one smoke detector goes off, then all of a sudden the whole house is making noise. And that's actually a really, really important factor, because what we found over the years is that the beeping that the smoke alarms make, they're really great at waking up adults. They're not so great at waking up children. So if the adults can be alerted, then we can get the kids out there.
Mm-hmm. So that connection happens only with new construction? Can it be retrofitted?
It can be retrofitted. In fact, there's a lot of smoke detectors use Bluetooth technology now. So if you are adding bedrooms onto your house, then you can add that smoke detector into the bedroom and then have it wirelessly connect to your existing system.
Okay. So when should people test or replace their smoke alarms?
As far as testing goes, it should be done every month. There's a button on every smoke detector. All you have to do is push that thing. It's going to beep and make noise and go through its cycle of whatever it is that it's testing, whether it be smoke or for carbon monoxide, and it tests the battery as well. Do that to each one of your smoke detectors every month. That's we used to say change your batteries or change your clocks, change your batteries. That resulted in a lot of wasted batteries. So now just check them every month, and if one of them doesn't go off or it doesn't sound right, then it's time to replace those batteries.
All right. And why is the battery so important, especially if they're kind of hardwired into the house?
So living up here in the mountains, we've had some pretty gnarly storms, and we've all experienced those times when the power goes out. It's important that our life safety systems continue to work even when the power is out. So that battery backup is a pretty cheap life safety second line of defense, we'll say.
Okay. And certainly our furnaces are on. Why are carbon monoxide detectors so important?
Carbon monoxide is an odorless, tasteless, and invisible gas that's there anytime we have combustion. So anytime you're burning something, you are going to have carbon monoxide. With furnaces, unless it's an electric furnace, so anytime you have a gas furnace or even a fuel-fired, so say like a log or propane or gas fireplace, you're going to have that carbon monoxide. The carbon monoxide detectors will tell you pretty quick if you have a large buildup of carbon monoxide in your house. And because the symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning, especially the early symptoms, they're just kind of, you just don't feel good. You kind of have a headache. Some of the big symptoms we talk about, rosy red cheeks and rosy red lips, those don't come along until a lot later. So it's important for those carbon monoxides to be there to let you know when you are being exposed. And I've personally seen some pretty bad situations where carbon monoxide detectors were not in homes that they should have been in, and where we had many, many patients. Luckily, and I can't think of any cases where anyone died, but there were some pretty close calls that we had out there. Again, it's cheap insurance. You can buy little ones that don't have to be installed. You just plug them right into an outlet, and they're sitting there protecting you. We recommend one on every floor of your house.
Okay, and also, do you need to test those like you do with smoke alarms?
You should, yes. And carbon monoxide detectors, they tend to last about 7 years before they need to be replaced. You'd asked earlier how often smoke detectors need to be replaced. After about 10 years, you need to get new ones. The little sensors in there will stop functioning correctly. And a lot of the ones that you buy today, once they hit that 7 or 10 year mark, they stop working. Well, they start going off usually about 2 o'clock in the morning. You can't shut them off.
Yeah, okay. So those absolutely need to be replaced then.
Yes.
That starts happening. Well, let's talk a little bit about just the cooking and baking. I'm guessing that may be one of the biggest calls you get in terms of kitchen fires.
So nationwide, cooking is the number one cause of fires. The National Fire Protection Association releases statistics every year gathered from fire departments across the country. And this year, as in years past, for a long time, it's been cooking fires is both the number one cause of fires in homes, as well as the number one cause of deaths in fire, or number one cause of fires that resulted in deaths.
Yeah, so what kind of fires are you seeing? I mean, what is it that somebody's doing or not doing that creates the fire?
So there's two big things that come from cooking fires. One of them is just simply leaving stuff too close to the stove. If you have something that falls over onto a burner and then catches on fire, towels are a very common cause. That's something that's pretty preventable. The other one is inattention. So sometimes we'll start something cooking and then we'll forget about it. You know, you may start heating up some oil. and then you walk away or you leave something. In my house, we have one of our neighbors, they give us a gift every year of it's a little packet of orange peels and cloves and cinnamon that we can put in water and then boil on our stove, and it makes our house smell great. Well, that's wonderful as long as we remember to put water in there. So anytime you have that stove on, that stove going, you really, really need to be right there with it, not just walking away.
Yeah, so once the water boils down, I mean, what's catching fire? The pan?
The material inside the pan catches on fire. And then when you think about a kitchen, sometimes you have these big open kitchens with a nice vent above it, above the stove, and you know those tend to manage themselves. A lot of the times, though, you have cabinets above your stove or cabinets close to your stove, and so that's how we see those fires spread.
Okay, and grease fires are a little bit different than just something burning on the stove. What do people need to know about that?
In my personal opinion, grease fires are about the worst thing that can happen, and that's for two reasons. First of all, the end result of them can be absolutely tragic to a person who tries to put it out if they don't put it out easily. Grease fires are very easy to put out. The key is cover whatever's on fire. So if you have a pan that's the grease is caught on fire, just cover that, move it off the stove, and most of the time that's going to be okay. Never, ever, ever, ever pour water on a grease fire. That is the worst thing you can do. Water expands to about 1,700 times its size when it turns into a vapor. That blows the grease everywhere, and so it catches everything around it on fire, as well as the person who's putting it out. So, you know, the big takeaway here is if you do have a grease fire, just cover it, turn the heat off, and that's the thing to do. That's really the big thing. Those are what scare me the worst about kitchen fires.
Hmm. We talked a little bit about fireplaces, but let's go back there. I mean, what do people need to know about fireplaces, especially if they got hot ash?
Okay, thank you for asking that, because every year we go on a couple of dumpster fires, whether it be from someone who's just in town for a couple of days and they need to do something with their ashes, so they throw it in a dumpster, or whether it be someone who lives here or who's cleaning someplace and again just needs to dispose of the ashes, so they throw them in a dumpster. If you have a wood burning fireplace, one of the most important things that you can have is just a small metal bucket. And once your fire has burned down, you're cleaning those ashes out, put them in the metal bucket, put them outside, let them sit there for a couple of days, cool down all the way. Once they're cold enough to touch, it's okay to throw them in your dumpster. Before that, you got to keep them in that bucket. And just a little side note, I mean, ash is actually pretty good for your garden. So if you're looking to get rid of it and you have a place where you're a flower bed, then that's a good, once it's cooled down, that's a good place to put it. Don't want to burn your bulbs.
Okay. And then how big of a concern are space heaters?
Over the years, space heaters have become quite a bit more safe to use. In the past, we had to be very careful with them. They still have the potential to catch things on fire. If you have a brand new space heater, there's a lot of safety features built into it. The big risk is, of course, them being knocked over. If they're being used too close to combustible materials, then you have the potential of catching those materials on fire. If you have an old space heater, get rid of it. It uses too much energy and it's really not safe to use. The newer ones are much more power efficient and they're much, much safer to use. But just like the candles or the cooking, if you're not using it, if you're not there in the room, you don't need to be using it.
Yeah. And again, the new space heaters, they fall over, they shut off.
They do. They have switches on them that will shut off when they fall over.
Okay. And you mentioned extension cords with decorations. Anything else that people ought to be careful about with holiday lights and other decorations?
We have really seen a reduction in the number of fires that have been caused by holiday lights. And a lot of that has to do with there's two things actually. So we're seeing less and less natural trees out there. You know, people who have natural trees, you want to make sure that they're watered. You want to make sure that they're staying wet and cool and they're not drying out on you. Mix those natural trees with the old incandescent Christmas light bulbs, and now you have a heat source and something dry and a potential to catch on fire. With LED lights, we're not seeing that quite as much. However, one dangerous little spot with LED lights is that you can only plug so many of them into one plug at a time. There is heat generated usually near the plug for the LED lights. And so we want to make sure that when we're using those lights, a lot of them say you can string up to five strands together. Any more than that, you're going outside of that safe area.
Okay. So are live Christmas trees more dangerous than artificial ones?
Just because they have the potential to catch on fire. The artificial ones are constructed and then treated with chemicals so that they're less likely to catch on fire. They tend to melt more than catch on fire.
Okay. Let's see. What about generators or alternative heating during power outages? What do people need to know about that?
So the big deal there, and you mentioned it earlier, carbon monoxide is the big problem with the generators. We've seen some crazy stuff out there. We've seen people plug generators into a plug in their house so that it would give power to more outlets, which is an absolute no-no. I mean, first of all, you're there's some bad things that can happen just inside your house there, but then you're also backfeeding the electricity into the grid system, and you have potential to cause problems there. So that's not safe. Please do not do that. The other thing is, when you use them, make sure that they're used outside. You can't use them in the garage. You can't use them in the basement. They need to be outside so they get that fresh air so that they can combust, and then they're getting rid of that carbon monoxide. Now, that let me just mention, that is different from the batteries. You can buy backup batteries, which are perfectly safe to use inside.
All right. A note to residents, how is it that, or what is it that they should do perhaps to help first responders in the event that you do show up for an emergency? I mean, you know, we often hear about, you know, maybe having a DNR or something, you know, that people need to see.
So there's two sides there. If you do have a loved one who has a DNR, do not resuscitate is what that stands for. There are orders signed by a doctor saying that this person has progressed to the point in their life where they've chosen not to be resuscitated for one reason or another, if they become unconscious or if their heart stops beating. It is important that those documents be there with us. We have to treat that patient as though they don't have one unless we have a copy of those documents on site. But you know, the other thing, and any time we get called is a stressful time. The days when we're able to help someone the most is someone's worst day. And we recognize that. So if you have a neighbor who's having a hard time, if you see something going on, we need you to stay back and let us deal with the people who are having a hard day. So give us a little bit of room so we're able to do our job. And then the other part of that, probably the bigger picture thing is, know your neighbors, know who's around you, know if they're having a hard time, if something's going on. You know, it's a lot easier to check on someone every day to make sure they're doing okay than suddenly wake up in the morning and think, oh dear.
Yeah, and what are some of the other things? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, make sure your walkways are shoveled, you know, make sure you got lights on and an address you can read.
That's the addresses are a big deal, and it's kind of funny. We work with a lot of builders as they're building houses, and the question comes up with, you know, why do you really need the address? If it's on fire, you're going to find the house, it's on fire. And they're absolutely right. If your house is on fire, we're going to find the fire. But if there's someone who's having a heart attack or a breathing problem or any other medical problem, it's a little bit harder to find them. So addresses that match that are the same color of your house cause us a lot of problems. We need contrasting numbers on your house. It needs to be visible from the street. And that's really what we're looking for there.
Okay. Anything else, Mike, you wanted to mention?
You know, I love this community, Leslie. This is such a great place. And as we're moving into this time of the year when we have more and more people, just watch out for each other, be safe, and have a great time. That's what we're here for.
Okay. Happy holidays, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Mike Owens, again, is the Public Information Officer for the Park City Fire District. Well, the Youth Sports Alliance and Kodiak, a local Park City business, are renewing their partnership for the third consecutive year. In the studio with details, I have the Executive Director of Youth Sports Alliance, Emily Fisher. On the phone, I have Lily Kozad. She is Kodiak's Senior Partnership Manager. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Emily, let me start with you and maybe talk to us just a little bit about why is this an important partnership for Kodiak to join forces with Youth Sports Alliance?
Yeah, this is our third year of partnering with Kodiak as the title sponsor of our after-school programs, Get Out and Play and Activate. And it's been a really great partnership. They've allowed us to expand, work with our scholarship students in a more meaningful way and just have some more resources so we can put some more time and energy into marketing the programs, into making sure that the students are not just have a scholarship, but all have all the proper gear, proper clothing, helmets, goggles, all of those things. They also provide Kodiak bars for all of our programs, which is a significant investment on their part. So it's just allowed us to grow our programs in a easier, quicker, more efficient way.
So Kodiak is one of how many partnerships that YSA has?
We have a lot of different partnerships with venues in town and with people that run our programs, but Kodiak is our title sponsor of our after-school programs. And it has been a really significant partnership, both financially and, as I said, support in the community, support with snacks. And so they are really the most significant funder that isn't a vendor or a venue. So it's been an amazing partnership with them.
Lily, so why is the Youth Sports Alliance an organization that Kodiak supports? Again, you could partner with, you know, just about anybody.
Yeah, we could. But, you know, what we really love about YSA is just their shared mission. Our mission is to fuel epic days and wilder lives. And what we love about YSA is that they're on board with that. And we share a lot of common values and just the importance of being able to get youth outside and being able to fuel for adventure.
Yeah. You have any idea how many other partnerships that Kodiak has with other nonprofit groups?
Yeah, we have a list of different nonprofits that we work with, but we're really excited to be partnering with YSA for this third year, and we have a lot of really exciting things coming down the pipeline.
Okay. So what does the partnership include? You certainly mentioned products. I mean, is it also a cash contribution?
Yep, absolutely. So they do, they, as our title sponsor, they contribute cash. And what's been really significant is to see how our scholarships and discounts have grown in those 3 years. It used, prior to this partnership, it was about 21 to 25% of our participants received assistance, and now 41% of our students receive scholarships or discounts. So we have a tiered system for scholarships, free and reduced lunch. Families pay just a small commitment fee. Families making less than $120,000 annually pay 50%, and then we have the full retail rate. But we also provide discounts for siblings, for first responders, for teachers. Like I said, we're just trying to figure out all the barriers that exist for kids participating, and then how can we address those barriers? And this funding really helps us.
Yeah, so is the money that Kodiak donates, is it specifically for those with financial aids? It's kind of a restricted fund then?
It is specifically for our after-school programs. So whether that's transportation, whether that's gear, whether that's you know, helping the venues with some of their fees that we have to pay to the venues. It's sort of all the expenses, and it's helping with some of our programs in Wasatch and South Summit, North Summit. They have helped fund our pilot program in Salt Lake City. So we can really try to offer those programs at the same cost. Our program costs have not gone up in 10 years, and obviously our costs have gone up. So we just make that commitment to the community to try to make the programs as affordable as possible for every student in our communities.
Okay, Lily, tell us a little bit about Kodiak. I mean, I think it's Park City based, right?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, so Kodiak is a better for you food company, best known for our protein packed flapjack and waffle mix. And we're, again, like I said, we're all about fueling epic days and wilder lives. We use 100% whole grains and protein across everything that we make, from breakfast to snacks. Again, like Emily said, the bars that we donate to YSA. And this year is actually our 30th anniversary. And yeah, we're based here in Park City.
Did you say 30th anniversary?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that we've been around for so long, but yeah, 30 years.
Wow, no, I didn't know that either. That seems like a, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a really cool story. Our founder grew up in Park City area, and it all started him bringing around his little red wagon through the neighborhood, selling his mom's whole grain, whole wheat pancake mix, and it's kind of just evolved from there.
Okay. Emma, I guess just kind of looking back at the year, tell us what kind of impact YSA has had.
Yeah, during the last year, so the 2024-25 school year, we had over 3,200 students participate in 184 different after-school programs across the Wasatch Back. That was a 25% increase in participation from the year before. So we are definitely experiencing growth. We're experiencing a lot of interest in our programs. I think it's a really affordable way just to get kids off their screens, help them feel included in the community, and make sure that they're getting active and outdoors and playing with their friends. So we are looking to beat that number again this year, and we are deeply appreciative to Kodiak's support for helping us with that growth and supporting our growth with awesome bars. And I've made 1 billion Kodiak cakes for my kids, so I can appreciate them as a parent and as a nonprofit executive.
Okay. Lily, anything else you wanted to add?
No, just that we're super excited. Again, this is our third year, so I have a feeling this is going to be the best one. We are going to get together here soon and start getting some really cool activations together, so watch out.
Okay. Lily Kozad, Emily Fisher, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The owner of Park Meadows Plaza proposing to turn the office park into a more modern mixed-use project. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it wants special code exceptions to do that.
The owner of Park Meadows Plaza is Boston-based Kensington Investment Company. It has an office at Prospector and owns a handful of properties in that area through different LLCs. The company also owns Utah's tallest building, the new Astra Tower in Salt Lake City. It's midway through talks with the Park City Planning Commission about redeveloping the office park on Kearns Boulevard, currently home to the restaurant Tupelo, Park City Bike and Demo, and Create PC. Kensington is proposing 117 total housing units, 20 of which would be affordable. Parking would be underground. During a second discussion Wednesday, Kensington again asked for increased building heights and reduced setbacks from neighboring roads and properties, despite skepticism during its first Planning Commission meeting in August. Kensington has also provided the city with a rendering of what the current zoning would allow without any height or setback exceptions. Commissioner Rick Shand said it was interesting to consider.
Even though that complies with code, that's totally unacceptable. It creates a three-story, even though it's below height limits, three-story frontage on our entry corridor and a open space area inside that kind of building kind of reminds me of the Pentagon a little bit.
But just because Shan prefers the other layout doesn't mean he's sold on the setbacks that Kensington says it requires. The developer is asking for 10 feet rather than 25 in some areas. Commissioner Bill Johnson was particularly concerned about reduced setbacks next to the future Holiday Village and Parkside Apartments project. Park Meadows Plaza is between the Kearns Boulevard Wells Fargo branch and the pending HOPA affordable housing. It's also kitty corner to the Bonanza Park 5-acre site where the Park City Council is working with the developer to create another mixed-use community. Commissioner Henry Sigg, a developer himself, wants to look at the Kensington project in that context going forward.
I never like to look at a project in the context of what the alternative could be. I would like to look at a project that's brought forward as the project. I don't want to look at, well, if we don't get this, well, you can get this.
Sigg asked the developer Wednesday to bring drawings next time that visualize the height from a different angle than the overhead two-dimensional renderings. Only the innermost portions of the proposed buildings would extend above the 35-foot height limit up to 50 feet. Commissioner John Frontero has been the least welcoming to the proposal. That's primarily because city code says buildings with reduced setbacks should be shorter and that taller buildings should have more setbacks. The Planning Commission did not vote on the Kensington project and hasn't yet scheduled a third conversation. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Police Department added another officer to its ranks last week. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that he's a chocolate lab named Bruno, and he's the department's very first canine.
Park City Mayor Nan Worrell officially swore in the Park City Police Department's newest member, Bruno, during the City Council meeting Thursday night. Bruno is a chocolate lab trained to detect the scent of 20 different explosives. The police department says Bruno graduated from the Utah Peace Officers Standards and Training Canine School this week and is considered its unofficial valedictorian. As part of the swearing-in ceremony, Worrell asked Bruno to promise to support, obey, and defend the United States and Utah constitutions.
If you accept these responsibilities, then catch this ball.
Bruno fumbled the grab on his first try, but then scooped it up to earn the badge that was pinned to his collar as a crowd of over 30 locals cheered on. They included students from Austin Borjigin's 5th grade McPullen Elementary class, who won a school contest to give the four-legged crime fighter his name. Student Elise Bodner said she was the one who pitched the name and loved seeing Bruno be sworn in.
I thought it really suited him, and I thought it had a good chance at winning. and it was funny to watch him catch the ball.
Student Kyo Trotwine clarified that the canine's full name is Bruno the Bomb Sniffer. Officer Wayne Henderson is Bruno's handler. He said Bruno is trained to sniff out the chemicals and materials used to make explosives. He currently has 20 scent certifications, but Henderson said that number will go up. He says Bruno will doggedly work to keep the community safe. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Park City Council is moving forward with plans for the 2026 Sundance Film Festival. The Yarrow Doubletree Hotel will officially return as a festival venue. The council has approved the plans for the 2026 festival, the last in Utah, before moving to Boulder, Colorado. Next year's festival runs January 22nd through February 1st. Park City Council member Ryan Dickey said, overall, Old Town will operate much like 2025 with a few changes.
It's going to look really similar to prior years. They're activating the Doubletree as a theater again.
And for the first time since 2023, the Yarrow Doubletree by Hilton Hotel will return to host a full 10-day slate of films. This comes amid one of the festival's most notable changes. The Historic Egyptian Theater will not screen films for the first time since Sundance came to Park City in 1981. Theater manager Randy Barton previously told KPCW that the space is no longer set up for film. However, according to council documents, it may host a one-day panel discussion. And for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic, the Echo Center will host showings and events both weeks of the festival. Similar to 2025, no vehicles will be allowed on Park City's Main Street for the first 5 days of Sundance. As Main Street pedestrian traffic wanes, Dickey said that roads and parking will start to reopen.
Sometimes residents get frustrated. It feels like it's hard to park and get to Old Town when it feels a little more empty. So that Tuesday of Sundance, parking and the streets will return back to normal.
He said that attendance at the top of Main Street was limited in 2025, so the council now working to secure more activations from top to bottom.
You had people walking up the street saying, wow, isn't this great? And they kind of get to the area where the bars are and there's music playing and they sort of stop.
Acura returns to the Bob Will Plaza. Hulu will have a Little Miss Sunshine activation at the Galleria parking lot, and Chase Sapphire will be located at 625 Main Street. The city encourages locals and visitors to use public transit to relieve parking pressure. Buses will run from the Richardson Flat Park and Ride lot every 20 minutes between 6 a.m. and 2 a.m. In the studio now with an update from Park City Recreation is Director Ken Fisher. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with an update. First, we've got the new mine at City Park Community Center, a name, but not a building yet. So this is set to be open when?
It should be open a year from now. So it's moving along. You'll start to see that building going vertical here in the next week or two. They'll be starting all the brickwork and block.
Okay. And it took a while because you had to, like, reroute sewer lines and...
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, there was a lot of utility work that had to be done from rerouting sewer lines, new water lines, bringing all the utilities into the site needed, but... It's really been moving along well.
Okay. What are you excited about that community center? I mean, what are people going to find inside?
You know, I think the community is really going to be surprised, I think, when they see it. It really is about 6 feet up above the field, so you really get spectacular view sheds out across the park and the softball field and all that. I think it's really going to be a desirable place for people to come and hold events and birthday parties and for us to program. It's going to be spectacular.
Yeah, so I mean, what kind of, just tables and chairs, or is there going to be more inside
there's more inside the, I'd call it a small gymnasium type space that we're building that has about a 25-foot ceiling that certainly will be used by day camp where kids can go in there and we can play dodgeball or you can kick a ball around and you're not going to break anything from that end. And then we have two areas that are also somewhat classroom type space where you have a dividing wall that you can pull across and either have one large space or two smaller spaces. And those are set up with the technology so that people could hold meetings in that and there. And then we have a big, I'll call it a community room, that has a catering kitchen and glass doors that open out to a big patio that will look out over the park. I mean, that space is really going to be spectacular.
Yeah. Let's see. How big and how much are we paying for it?
It is a 15,000 square foot building, and our budget is all in about $19 million.
Okay. And tell us about the pool remodel at the Mark. Are they able to do construction in the winter?
Oh, yeah, that's moving along. You know, the pool is, it's a MRSA-type pool, so they, if anyone that's been to the Mark and looked out there, you can see where they're installing the panels for the walls of the pool, and you can see the shape of that leisure pool. So that is also moving along quickly. They will... they've gotten all the plumbing done on that, and they will start to backfill that and dig out the lap pool, hopefully in the next couple of weeks here.
Okay. Dig out the lap pool.
Yeah, the lap pool hasn't been dug yet just because of the two pools next to each other. It's a tight site, so we have to really finish off the leisure pool or the play pool and then start on the lap pool.
Okay, it's been drained at this point. Yeah, it's just...
Oh, yeah, it's gone. Yeah.
Okay, and then will they be able to, I guess since the hole's already there, is it taking a similar footprint?
It's actually, the lap pool's a little bit bigger. It is going to be 8 lanes versus 6 lanes, and it also shifts back to the east a little bit. So we're able to... that's really how we're able to get the play pool down in the same area.
Okay. And then completion of those two pools is expected when?
They should be open this summer. We're shooting for a June 1st opening.
Okay. Now, both projects were done without a bond. So where did the financing come to pay for these?
Yeah, so the community center was financed through... they issued, it's in the Lower Park Ave RDA, and they issued bonds against those proceeds. The city did a number of years ago, and originally it was going towards an affordable housing project. Changes in the city strategy, so on and so forth, it made that funding available to be used in the Lower Park for the mine. And then for... the pools, that was funded just through general fund excess revenue.
Okay, and the cost of those two, the budget for the, both of those pools?
The pool's about $10 million.
Okay. All right, what about the racquetball indoor, not racquetball, pickleball indoor courts at Quinn's Junction? Is that project moving forward?
That's moving along. Yeah, we've been working with, working on trying to get a ground lease signed here, but that is moving along, and hopefully there'll be some more news on that in the, you know, shortly.
Okay. So with the holidays here, you do have some special holiday hours. Let us know about those.
Yeah, so on the 24th, we close at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Closed on Christmas Day, the only day that we're actually closed all year. And then on the 31st, on New Year's Eve, we close at 6 p.m. And on the 1st, we open at 9 a.m. on New Year's Day. We have fitness classes on the 24th on Christmas Eve, and then also on New Year's Eve on the 31st. So just check our schedule. I mean, they'll be abbreviated. We obviously won't have a full schedule since we're closing early, but we will be holding classes.
Okay. And you also offer working parents winter break camp for when kids are out of school?
Yeah, so we have 2 weeks of that. The second week is already sold out, and there's a wait list. So if you need that second week, I encourage you to get on that wait list and see if we can get you in there. The first week goes, we have spots, and that runs December 22nd, 23rd, and 26th. In that, they have daily field trips. They're going to go down to the Living Planet Aquarium. They do Hangtime Adventure Park, and they go to Tracy Aviary.
Okay. Let's see. You also have a racket sports holiday social coming up.
Yeah, we got lots of socials and things going on. So on the 19th of December, I think it's this Friday, from 3 to 5, it's a tennis and pickleball potluck. We already have about 25 people registered, so it's a pretty good turnout. It's $10, and you can come and play tennis and pickleball and get to know some other members of the community.
Okay. And you also offer coffee and tennis every other Friday. What's that about?
Yeah, this is a new program that Our racket sports division has started. It's every other Friday. Goes from 7 to 8:30 in the morning. It's only $5. So it's all abilities can come. It's round robin, and you get, we serve coffee and pastries or bagels after that. And actually, we need for you to pre-register for that. And this Friday's is actually sold out, but the ones on the 9th and 23rd have spots available in January.
Okay. And that schedule is online then?
Yes, correct.
All right. You also have a candy cane hunt happening. When's that?
Yeah, that's also this Friday. That's from 5:30 to 6:30. It's a fun event we've been doing for the past 4 or 5 years. We usually try to do it outside, but given the construction at the Mark, that space wasn't available, and then also given what's going on with the construction in City Park. So we're going to do that in our gymnasium. It's a fun event where we will shut off all the lights, we hide candy canes around, and kids bring a flashlight and search for the candy cane, similar to like an Easter egg hunt. And that's 5:30 to 6:30. There's also a craft involved in that.
Great. All right. Hey, I wanted to ask you, I know that one of the big projects next year for the golf course will be irrigation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any chance the city would consider adding snowmaking equipment to maybe like the front nine there on the 3K?
That's a good question, Leslie. I wouldn't say, that's something, I don't know what's involved in adding snowmaking. I know it would need to be a different system than an irrigation line. Mm-hmm. But that's something that, if we get direction from city council, we could certainly investigate that.
Yeah, and I mean, when you have a year like this year, right, it's kind of like, oh man, where do you go Nordic ski? And, you know, I noticed that Soldier Hollow, they had, you know, a kilometer open, but it's something.
Yeah, right. I mean, just sort of spitballing here, it might be something that's easier to get done out in Quinn's area. But, you know, that's a good question to see.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Ken?
I'd add one more program that we have coming up. We have a Winter Wilderness First Aid Clinic. That's on the 13th of January. It's from 5:30 to 7:30 in the evening. And really, it's a class for you to gain your first aid skills that you need for winter sports that we all enjoy.
Okay. Ken Fisher, thanks for your time this morning. Happy holidays.
Thanks, Leslie. Same to you.
Well, options are limited for every snow sport among this persistent warm temperatures in the Wasatch Back. Although both Deer Valley and Park City Mountain are open, few trails are open, and the daily high temperature still in the 50s. Even at the upper elevations, conditions look more like spring than winter. In the backcountry, Utah Avalanche forecaster Drew Hardesty described the conditions as stop-and-go mashed potatoes.
We just have a pretty thin and threadbare snowpack, just 1 to 2 feet of snow up high, and the only cold snow that exists is along the higher reaches of the north-facing aspects, and that's fairly wind-damaged.
For snowshoers, fat bikers, and cross-country skiers, options are scant here in the Wasatch Back. The Mountain Trails Foundation encouraging bikers to enjoy the paved paths or the frozen dirt trails around town instead of searching for snow. Single-track trails at Bonanza Flat are still too soft for fat biking. Meanwhile, although the foundation is grooming Nordic Track at Bonanza, the cover is thin and variable due to the warm weather. Soldier Hollow outside Midway is one exception for Nordic skiers. It opened with about 1 kilometer of trails, thanks to machine-made snow. Staff recommends skiing early in the morning when weather is cooler. It's an unusually dry start to the winter for Utah. KSL reports snowpack is the lowest it's been for early December in at least 25 years. Warm temperatures continuing this week. The National Weather Service reporting Park City will see temperatures in the low 50s through tomorrow, while Heber City could have highs into the mid to upper 50s this week. Early forecasts show a mix of rain and snow arriving Tuesday night on into Wednesday.